Welcome to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morado, and today I'm very honored to have a special guest from India, and former Ambassador Prakash. Ambassador, it's so good to have you on the podcast today. Could you take just a brief moment to introduce yourself to the listeners and some of your storied career?
Well, delighted to talk to you. I have been a diplomat of 35 years standing. My last few assignments were Ambassador or High Commissioner to Canada, Ambassador to South Korea, the official spokesperson of the State Department, Consul General to Shanghai, and various other assignments, including a friendly country called Pakistan, Japan, USA, Russia. I've been around.
Yeah, I would say so. So.
And by the way, at present, I'm a foreign affairs analyst. I write regularly. I'm a TV panelist and also a speaker on a variety of subjects.
Well, let me just say, sir, it is a very high honor to have such a wealth of knowledge on board the podcast, and let's get right into the questions because I'm very excited.
Sure.
First of all, today just wanted to discuss with you one of the ongoing headlines that's probably foremost on a lot of people's minds in regards to India right now, which is the current border tensions with the People's Republic of China. And I was wondering, you know, it seems to be a topic of a great deal of interest, obviously, inside of both India and China. But surprisingly, from an American perspective, there's very little talk about it in the news media in the more Western half of the world. Perhaps you could fill in our listeners just a brief background of what's led to the current tensions and what the underlying issues are.
Well, first of all, I would like to congratulate the People's Republic of China for doing what has been what seemed impossible 6 months ago to antagonize the whole world. They have done a very good job of it.
They have indeed.
Starting from the U.S. Across the globe to it started with Wuhan virus or the coronavirus, which was hidden from the world for weeks. And we have seen the consequences. Your great country has been perhaps one of the worst sufferers.
Indeed.
Of the onslaught. And China has been pretty even-handed. They have picked up fights with everybody, including Japan, Australia, the ASEAN countries, tiny Bhutan. Bhutan, which is a small Himalayan country, with them, with Myanmar, with India. I mean, you name it. Now, we have a history of difficulties. China is our northern neighbor. We have a 3,500-kilometer long border, which has not been demarcated. It's a difficult border because it's along the Himalayas, and it can be quite a treacherous territory. We have had a conflict in 1962. There are a variety of reasons. We don't have time to get into that. But since 1975, not a single bullet was fired. Not one life was lost till recently, and we had a number of confidence-building measures, agreements, understandings, including the 1993 agreement to maintain peace and tranquility along the border. The current Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, has gone out of the way to engage with China, knowing fully well their expansionist tendencies, in order to find a modus vivendi. And then we find that one day in late May, they amassed troops along the line of control in the area of Ladakh, which is one of the union territories of India, and Sikkim. Next, we have fist fights. And on the 15th, 16th night, 20 of our soldiers were slaughtered, unprovoked, premeditated, and using medieval weapons. Can you imagine in this time, day and age?
It's a remarkable thing for 2020, it really is.
Yes, to use baseball bats studded with barbed wires and batons with nails in it. It's a different matter that our soldiers, though outnumbered, gave it back to them in kind and slayed more than 40 of them. So that is the true face of China, which has was exposed for the entire world to see.
Yes, indeed. And it is interesting. I love how you opened your discussion with the important point that China has seemed to aggravate just about everybody, whether it's from Hong Kong security law to the Chinese-Indian border. Do you yourself, sir...
Did I hear you say law?
I'm sorry?
Did I hear you say law?
Law, in Hong Kong.
Agreements, covenants, treaties, understandings means nothing.
Yes.
To this power. For them, these are only tools of convenience.
Absolutely.
To be used when applicable, to be discarded when not applicable.
That's a very good description, sir. I would agree with that entirely. And given your extensive experience in the Indo-Pacific broadly, do you see a particular motivation for Beijing in the actions they're taking? Are they attempting to shift focus from the coronavirus disaster and their slowing economy, or do you see something deeper in terms of expansionism on the long term? Do you see a coordinated strategy, or are they sort of flailing at the moment?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. To peer into the Chinese mind is not the easiest of things to do, but it is very well known that they'll say something and do something else. Now, there are assessments being made. My own assessment, which I've been writing about and speaking about, is that they saw India distracted with the pandemic, which we are currently facing. And they also were under global pressure for not only in allowing the world to suffer the way they did, but then to try and change the narrative, to expect the world to be grateful to them, to use the kind of language that they have been using against any and every country which has tried to question them. And our own assessment, or my own assessment, is that President Xi Jinping was under internal pressure. He is an autocrat. He is, I would like to use a stronger adjective, but out of my training and respect, I will not. The problem with autocrats is that they live in a bubble.
They are given
to shooting the messenger. So nobody dares bring the bad news. Mm. And then you're in an echo chamber where everybody repeats what he has heard. President Xi Jinping believes that he's a monarch, he's an emperor, and everything should go according to what he wishes. He has been following a very aggressive foreign policy. So it was a variety of reasons to teach India a lesson, because Beijing is trying to craft a China-centric world order, an Asian order, where they see India as an irritant or a potential adversary, whatever you call it, because of her size and so on. They cannot take on the U.S. Directly, so it's a message to the U.S., it's a message to Hong Kong, it's a message to Taiwan, to Xinjiang, what have you, that look, we brook no nonsense, we will have it our way. And also internally in India, we have hitherto, along the line of actual control, as we call it, or the India-China border, infrastructure on our side was lacking. For a variety of reasons. China was building infrastructure. Under 6 years of Modi administration, Prime Minister Modi's administration, there has been rapid buildup of infrastructure on our side. But because we are building infrastructure, it is wrong on our side. When China does it on their side or whichever side, it is right. So that is how it is. So, they are very uncomfortable. We are building infrastructure. They are very uncomfortable that we are improving relations with the U.S., they are uncomfortable that there is a grouping called Quad, of which U.S. is a member, and a variety of reasons. But basically, in their scheme of things, they want to keep India contained and confined to the South Asian theater, and to tell India that, look, we are the hegemon, we will do what it takes.
And that's an interesting point as well, in light of China's long-term strategic ambitions. And I saw in the news a couple of hours ago, I think it was in Bloomberg, They mentioned that there is currently underway a troop drawdown from both sides of the border, both for China and India. Do you see that as a productive move towards de-escalation, or is this simply a pause in a longer-term conflict?
Well, let me put it this way. If 45 years of painstakingly crafted agreements and understandings and discussions and commitments at the highest level are not worth the paper they are written on, they have gone up the smoke in a jiffy. What does one expect? So basically, you know that this country does not abide by any rules. Everything is tactical. On a very serious note, the big difference between the free world, democratic world as we know it, is that for us, conflict begins when diplomacy ends. Conflict is the last option. For China, and this is a very well-established thing, conflict or aggression is a tool of diplomacy. So it reinforces diplomacy and goes hand in hand. So they have no difficulty in using violence. Now, they are withdrawing, certainly from certain pockets. In the Pangong Lake area, they are still holding firm. What stops them from coming back tomorrow? How do we know that it's not a tactical retreat? Chances are that they thought that India, and let's face it, we have a power differential with China. China has a bigger power, bigger economy, larger per capita income. But let's not forget, they are the aggressor. When you are an aggressor, you need far more military muscle than when you are in a defensive position. So we don't covet their land. We don't want to be the aggressor. So we are there. We have the capability today to safeguard our interests. But they thought that we will succumb or blink like many other geographically smaller countries have been. The very fact that our soldiers were... And by the way, I need to point out about the discipline and professionalism of Indian soldiers, and I would like to know if there's one parallel in the world. Because there is a 1993 agreement on to maintain peace and tranquility and not use weapons, our soldiers, small contingent, when they were ambushed and their chief, their commanding officer was killed, they had weapons, but they did not use it.
That underscores that point you said again about the difference between democracies and an autocratic form of government, that India as a democracy has a respect for that treaty, that agreement, and for the rule of law, even under fire.
Very much so. But even a democracy, by the way, I mean, I for one believe that our soldiers went a little too far in honoring it. When your life is at risk, tell me one army man in the world who is trained to defend himself and inflict injury and maintains that kind of discipline. So I mean, that's an aside, but that shows the professionalism. So to answer your very valid question, they thought that, you know, we will succumb, but they have been perhaps taken back by the determination of India. And here was Prime Minister Modi, who went right at the border at 11,000 feet. And from there, he said that this is not the era of expansionism, and we will not allow expansionism to happen.
And that's a point I want to continue speaking about here, and I want to be respectful of your time as well, sir, so we'll try and keep this as short as possible. But I want to broaden the discussion slightly outward, if you're willing. India recently attained one of the rotating seats on the UN Security Council for the upcoming term. Given the emphasis on the rule of law and a resistance to expansionist or revisionist powers, say like China, possibly some people would say in different instances Russia as well, what are the priorities for India, in your view, for the coming term to start reestablishing a discussion at the highest level of the UN about bringing more stability, more order, more respect for the rule of law across the world?
Well, I'm proud to say that despite being a developing country and we are one of the countries with a lower per capita income, we have enjoyed an impeccable record of honoring every commitment, being the net security provider in the region, and being a very responsible stakeholder in the global affairs. So that is for you to check and for me to say. Now, we believe very strongly that the architecture of global governance has become outdated. You would perhaps agree with me that the economic geopolitics and the economic relationships which obtained in 1945 are slightly, quote-unquote, different from what they are in 2020.
Considerably. I mean, the fact you have a permanent members of the Security Council of France and England, who at the time were world empires and are now, you know, much smaller in terms of their economic and military influence, and the total exclusion of any South American power like Brazil, the total exclusion of India from a permanent seat, you know, it is a very different world from when it was created.
It is, because when the center of gravity, economic gravity and gradually political gravity is shifting to Asia, for countries like India, Germany, Japan, Brazil in particular, and certainly from the African continent, not to be represented is an oddity. And certainly and it's not just the UN Security Council, but practically every international arm of governance is outdated. So one is that we have been wanting to have it democratized. Two, there is the common challenge of terrorism. You mentioned that you had to go somewhere and you could not because of terrorism. And the world is in the grip of terrorism. So we have, since, believe it or not, since 1996, proposed a convention called the Comprehensive Convention on International Terrorism, and there is no agreement. Mm-hmm. Everybody says terrorism is back, but when you come to the nitty-gritty, there are difficulties. We have our neighbor where there is a whole terror infrastructure that obtains, and I'm talking of Pakistan, we are in the neighbor and we feel the heat, but it radiates across the globe. I mean, 70% of terror incidents, including in the US, and you can verify it, can be traced back to Pakistan. And yet, USA, for tactical reasons and strategic reasons, as President Trump said, has given billions and billions of dollars in assistance. Since 9/11, some $30 billion of assistance has been provided for Pakistan, which is training their guns at the American soldiers in Afghanistan. I mean, I needed to mention that.
Yes.
So basically, the agenda for the world is cut out. We have the difficult issue of climate change. We have the so many issues. We have the issue of poverty alleviation, pandemic management. Where there's a will, there's a way. We are hoping that we will play a constructive and positive role that India is known for.
Sir, would you have time for just two more questions? Would that be all right with you, sir?
Yes, please.
Okay,
yes,
perfect. Please. I want to touch on a somewhat related issue that may or may not be particularly relevant, which is the ongoing U.S. discussions for a peace process and potentially withdrawal from Afghanistan. Seeing as how India is located in the same general neighborhood, is there a position that New Delhi has staked out in those talks as well? Perhaps not as a direct participant, but as someone who will be impacted by the long-term fate of that country, particularly under the orbit of Pakistan and those terrorist groups you were mentioning?
Well, Afghanistan is an unfortunate nation. We have a very strong civilizational relationship with the people of Afghanistan, and we feel very sad that Pakistan has been using Afghanistan to acquire so-called strategic depth. And the people of Afghanistan have been the sufferers. They have faced nothing but hunger and violence and conflict for decades. So the fact that the U.S. and other allied powers were in Afghanistan, they helped in stabilizing the situation, especially upholding human rights, the violence against children, women started going to work, girl child was protected. I mean, it brought about a lot of improvement, but things are pretty difficult because when you have a country which provides safe haven, and I'm talking of Pakistan, and trains the Taliban, and then they come back to after their hits to Pakistan. So you have a difficulty. So yes, we being in the neighborhood, we are very concerned at the development. At the same time, we do know that the U.S. has been struggling with the issue. They have been at it for 20 years, and every country will do what is in their national interest. We have contributed our bit. We have been helping out in creating infrastructure as per the wishes of the Afghani people. And I'm happy to say that the stock of India and Indians is the highest in Afghanistan because of our non-interventionist and positive role that we have always played.
That's very well put, sir. And kind of as a closeout question, I know we're swinging around the world a little bit here, but mentioning India-U.S. relations more broadly, I recently noticed on your Twitter account you were discussing the new rollout of, I guess you would call it a policy, by the Trump administration regarding foreign student visas and the impact that that would have on Indian students currently studying and contributing to research here in the economy in the U.S. Would you care to speak about that subject at all and the impact of the new regulations?
I'll be happy to do that. Let me dwell on this a little because this is a very important thing.
Of course.
If you ask me which is the most important relationship for India today, without any question, it is the U.S. relations, India-U.S. relations. I was posted in Tokyo in 1998 when India went nuclear, and that, and then in 2000, fast forward to March 2000, Bill Clinton came on a five-day visit to India, and the relationship has never looked back. I mean, the relationship has been transformed. We have we are negotiating, discussing everything under the sun. Under successive American and Indian governments, the relationship has been strengthened, improved. And the best part is that unlike, let's say, any relationship with a dictatorial regime, there is no conflict of interest, long-term, short-term, medium-term, between India and the U.S. And U.S. has been very supportive towards the rise of India. It is our most important economic and trading partner, educational partner, energy, I mean, you name it. It's a relationship that we are proud of. And by the way, I think we will be recalibrating our relations now after this, our experience with China. And India-U.S. relations and India's relations with the Western world are bound to become stronger. So under this, with this background, you know, I would like to say that, yes, it's a matter of concern because out of the 1 million foreign students in the U.S., about 20% are from India. And 80% of them are in graduate studies because Indian students are very hardworking. And you know the kind of role, your class fellows have been Indians. You see
Absolutely.
The kind of role.
I can confirm that Indians firsthand. Yeah.
Indians are playing. Yeah. Indians are, I'm very happy to underline that with all humility. Indian diaspora, which is about 4 million strong, the richest expat community, Indian Americans in the U.S. We understand that this move is more to do with internal politics of the U.S. It is not directed against India or Indians. And in a matter of speaking, and I'm saying that because both my children have studied in the U.S., they live in the U.S., they have gained first-rate education, so I think I'm not speaking in abstract. The point is that if there is no classroom in-class tuition and it is only online, on balance, perhaps it is easier for the students to come back. I'm talking of Indian students to come back home. It will be more cost-effective. The visas have not been cancelled. I'm not defending the move, but what I'm saying is that it is something that we can deal with at a pinch, and they can, after the fall semester, they can go back again. It is not something which was warranted.
I would agree with
that. I don't
that.
Understand
yeah.
the logic of that.
Yeah.
But then, well, your president is the president of the USA, and he is, I think he it is in his infinite wisdom, if he wants to do that, well, so be it.
I would agree with that assessment generally, and I must say that I personally do not approve of the policy, and as someone who's benefited from friendships and connections with students from India, that I'd much rather have them here for the long term. And one final question on a related basis, given, and I don't want to plunge you into uncomfortable conversation, obviously, because it is internal U.S. Politics, but given the upcoming November elections and the way the polls are trending and so on, it would seem that former Vice President Joe Biden has a fairly strong chance, I would say, to most objective observers, of becoming the next president of the United States, the 46th president. If that were to occur, and January 20th of next year, former Vice President Joe Biden becomes President Joe Biden, what do you feel like that relationship between the U.S. and India, which is so important, would look like under a Biden administration? Would Prime Minister Modi's perspectives change? Would there be different dialogue, or do you see largely a continuity in spite of a leadership change?
I'm so happy you posed this very pertinent question. And I did mention the visit of President Clinton. So in the last 20 years, you have had President Clinton, President Obama, President Bush, President Trump, and now there'll be a president on the 20th of January 2021. We have had a number of administrations in India, and similar to the US, it has been Congress Party or BJP. What has happened? The relationship's trajectory has been only upwards. And for the simple reason, while personalities matter, the congruence of interest matters more. Since there is a convergence of interest of the U.S. and India, and we have no major conflict of interest, we are fellow democracies, as you mentioned, I am very sure that the relationship will continue to grow for the simple reason it is beneficial to India. I mean, India, certainly it's beneficial to India, it's beneficial to the U.S., and we reinforce each other. The Indians bring in a competitive edge economically and technologically to the U.S. You know, it's a relationship that we are proud of. A lot has been invested in the relationship by both sides. I'm as clear as it is that I'm speaking to you that the relationship will only go forward.
Well, and on that very positive note, I'm afraid we'll have to wrap it up. But, sir, it's been an absolute honor to interview you today, and just a pleasure to benefit from your wisdom and your years of experience and insight. And I want to say thank you for being on the New Diplomatist Podcast.
Well, thank you for reaching out to me, and hopefully on the 21st of January, we can have another chat.
I would love that, sir. I look forward to it. Thank you.
God bless. God bless.